Looks fine. Okay. Today is March 15th in the year 2000. This is Raymond Gerler, and I am interviewing Captain William Anderson in his home in Virginia. The purpose of this interview is for the Byrd Polar Research Center archival program on a grant sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Captain Anderson, I'd like to begin this interview with some basic questions about what attracted you to a career in the military, specifically the Navy. Who and what do you think were the principal influences and determining events?
I think two factors. I grew up during the Depression, and it was not at all certain in my family how much money would be available for college, and that led my father to ask one time, would I be interested in trying to get an appointment to one of the service academies? And I had done reading, seafaring type books, and had also seen a movie or two that glamorized the Naval Academy. So my response was that yes, I'd like to give it a try, and the first choice would be the Naval Academy.
So it was principally an economic decision. Why did you choose submarine duty? What attracted you to submarine duty?
Well, a couple of things. One, our class at the Naval Academy, class of 1943, was speeded up to graduate after 3 years because of the war, and accordingly we made only one summer cruise while at the academy. Normally you'd make at least two. During that summer cruise, which was on one of the old battleships, the USS Arkansas in this case, I grew less than fond of big ship duty. It was rather overwhelming in many respects, and somewhat crowded with all the midshipmen aboard and so on. So I made up my mind that a smaller ship would be preferable from my point of view. And then, of course, the submarine service being entirely consisting of volunteers was another factor. Fact that there's extra pay for submarine duty like there is for naval aviation. And then finally, when our class was about to graduate, the word came out that a goodly number of my classmates would be accepted directly to go to submarine school right out of the academy, whereas normally one would have to serve 2 years out in the fleet before you'd be eligible to go to submarine school. So this looked like an avenue to get things going, so to speak, rather quickly, and so I put in my application as first choice to go into submarines, and it was accepted, so that's how I started.
Can you discuss for the record a little bit about your sub experience in World War II?
Well, upon graduation from submarine school, this was in the fall of 1942, I was assigned directly to the Pacific, and in very short order was headed out on what amounted to my first experience in a submarine in combat on a war patrol. During the war, I served on three different submarines and made a total of 11 war patrols. Some of these were directed against enemy shipping. Some of these were doing resupply missions to the Philippines in support of the guerrilla warfare effort being carried out in the Philippines, and also the evacuation of Americans, including women and children that had been left in the Philippines and who had hid out in the hills upon the Japanese invasion. So it was a variety of experiences, and I was fortunate to come through all that without a scratch.
Okay, we're good. Can you discuss your advancement to the command of the Nautilus?
I was nominated by the Navy Bureau of Personnel and others to go to Washington and be interviewed by Admiral Hyman Rickover for a job that was not defined at that time. Being a submarine line officer, of course, my ambition would be that it had something to do with the growing new Navy nuclear submarine program, but I had no assurance that that was the case. I was interviewed by the Admiral. This was on a Saturday afternoon in Washington at his headquarters. I had waited all day long to see the Admiral, and his interview technique was rather straightforward, I found. For example, he started out asking where I'd gone to school, and I mentioned that I'd attended various schools because my family had moved around quite a bit. And then he broke into that, and he said, look, I didn't ask for your life history. Damn it, where'd you go to high school? Well, I went to two different ones, but I think you get the point that he was rather impatient. This was late in the day. After a bit, he asked me to name all the books that I had read in the prior 2 years, listing the title of the book, the author, and then a one-sentence resume of what the book was about. By then, he had me in a situation where I wasn't quite sure I even knew my own name, much less being able to reel off this type of information under that type of pressure. The fact was that I had read a great deal, but he concluded the interview when I showed some hesitation and said, goodbye, that's it. So I left the interview feeling that I had shot any possible chance of being accepted into his program. I got back home up in Connecticut and I told my wife about it, of course, and was very dejected over the outcome. And she suggested that, well, you've read this book, that book, so on and so forth, looking around the house, and she suggested, why don't you write Admiral Rickover and respond to his questions with a letter? And I thought, well, probably won't do any good, but won't do any harm, I guess. So I did that. Make a long story short, I was accepted into his program, and then in a training status, and after some months, I was the only line officer there for a while, only submarine line officer in his shop. After a while, became rather impatient to know what he had in mind, and he let me know finally after some months that, well, for purposes of training, let's assume that it might be to relieve Captain Wilkinson of the Nautilus. And of course, that was wonderful news, and I went to work very concertedly to learn the Nautilus history, program history, the Nautilus power plant, and all the other details that would prepare me for command of that first nuclear submarine.
And what happened to Captain Wilkinson, who was the first commander of the Nautilus, the
right.
First nuclear powered submarine?
Captain Wilkinson had done a superb job putting Nautilus in commission and shaking her down and demonstrating her capabilities. He was in demand to be the skipper of the first nuclear-powered surface ship, the cruiser Long Beach. So after his command tour was due to be over, he was assigned as prospective commanding officer of the Long Beach and went on to not just a successful command tour, but a very successful naval career, retiring eventually as a vice admiral.
Okay. I'd like to turn our attention now to the events leading to the Nautilus going under the ice to the North Pole. Can you describe the rationale and the context of the decision to send the Nautilus across the Arctic and under the North Pole? What led up to it? What were the objectives of the mission?
Okay, the as you know, the U.S. Navy had done some shallow ice, under ice penetration work in the early 50s with conventional submarines. These were very limited because when you're relying on a battery for propulsion, your submerged range is rather limited. When nuclear power came along, many of us had the thought that with that mode of power and the ability to steam fully submerged for literally weeks or months on end without connecting to the atmosphere, that here might be the means by which one could operate extensively under the polar ice pack. We had in mind, too, the report, whether it's completely true or not, I'm not sure, that the German U-boats in the North Sea lanes would occasionally, when subjected to counterattack from opposing anti-submarine warfare forces, would occasionally duck under the fringes of the ice pack in order to escape the attack. We were also very sensitive to the fact that Sir Hubert Wilkins in 1931, I believe, had the idea of traveling under the ice with a submarine and also incidentally named Nautilus. And he had the right idea, but his submarine was rather illy fitted for that task, and in that respect he was very much ahead of his time, but he had the right idea that it would be possible perhaps to travel extensively by submarine under the ice. So when I took command, which was in the summer of 1957, I was looking for an opportunity to do something different with the Nautilus. Captain Wilkinson had done a superb job in every category, and I was impatient to the extent that I didn't want to be just a repeat down his path road. I was looking for something new. I started reading everything I could about the Arctic and the ice pack, and during my tour of training under Admiral Rickover, and was on the look for an opportunity of perhaps giving Nautilus a try in that area. Nautilus, in the fall of, or rather I should say the late summer of 1957, shortly after I had taken over, was promised and was due to participate in a large NATO naval exercise, I put forward the proposal that since we were going up north in the northern waters off of Europe anyway, that here would be an opportunity perhaps to take a little time and to make some probes under ice with the ship. After promoting that concept for some time, I was finally able to convince the powers that be that we could have a 10-day period to do that, provided we were accompanied by a conventional submarine to stand by while we were under the ice pack, a buddy submarine, so to speak, which turned out to be the USS Trigger. We made three penetrations of the ice pack. My operation order had originally stated that we could proceed to latitude 87 north, 83 north, which was about 180 miles inside the ice pack. I had convinced the powers that be that let's at least put the word approximately in there, because we don't know exactly what we're going to expect. And of course I had in mind that if things went well, we might go a great deal further than 83 north, maybe even to the pole. It looked like during our second penetration that might be a possibility. We proceeded past 83 north and were doing well. Everything was working well till we got to a position about 180 miles from the pole. And then, due to something as commonplace as a blown circuit breaker, all of a sudden we lost all power to all navigation equipment except for a magnetic compass, which was rather useless, particularly in that area, because it was swinging back and forth through an arc of about 90 degrees. So about all it would tell you was that north was somewhere over there. It was evident with that loss of power to our compasses that we could no longer navigate with accuracy. We couldn't really tell where the North Pole was, and that we were in severe danger of getting into a situation of longitude roulette, where we wouldn't know how to find our way to the pole or even back out to open water. So reluctantly we turned around with great disappointment, and we did get ourselves pretty well lost in one respect, in that we ended up going into a shoaling water situation, which in retrospect was a sort of an ice-locked situation on the coast of Greenland. Fortunately, we made the correct decision to turn left and did eventually find our way out to open water. It was the experience of that mission which told us a lot, thanks to Dr. Waldo Lyon, who had provided the under ice measuring equipment, topside upward beamed fathometers that monitored the profile, underneath profile of the ice. Thanks to his work, we mapped the under ice profile over hundreds and hundreds of miles that hadn't been covered before. We mapped the undersea profile, the bottom profile, along routes that had never been sounded out before, except here and there, thanks to early explorers and to airplane landings on the ice and so forth. But we returned from that trip convinced that with some modifications to the ship, with improved compasses, and particularly with the addition of an inertial navigation system, which would be vastly more comfortable in northern latitudes near the pole than what we had had in 57, that a further exploration of the under ice would be indicated.
So this planted the idea in your mind then that you could do more than you had accomplished.
Definitely so. The timing was very crucial. Here was what was going on. We returned from that Arctic mission and the NATO exercise, getting back into our home port at New London, shortly after the Russian Sputnik had gone up. And I was called down to Washington to brief a group of officers in the Pentagon about what Nautilus had been doing. And I found that there was vastly more interest among that group on the what we had done incident to the NATO exercise than there was about the under ice venture, although there were two or three notable exceptions that had great interest and enthusiasm for the under ice potential of a submarine like the Nautilus. But the attitude generally in the Pentagon was about the Arctic under ice was, what have we lost up there? So we had sort of an uphill fight. But coming out of the Pentagon, just by chance, God-given chance, who did I run into but Captain Pete Arand, who was naval aide to President Eisenhower. We had met before briefly at Admiral Rickover's headquarters, where he paid a courtesy call on the Admiral when I was there. And so he recognized me and asked if he obviously I was waiting for a taxi or something, and he asked if he could give me a lift into town. And since I was heading back to the train station to go back to New London, I of course accepted. And during the car trip into town, he asked what we've been up to, what we've been doing, and I told him briefly about the Arctic work. And he asked if I could stay over and come to see him at his office the next morning. Of course, I agreed and was free to do so because our ship was in port and in upkeep. So I went to see captain ran the next morning, and he had a large chart of the world on the wall in his office, and his question to me was, would it be possible for you to take the Nautilus all the way around the world submerged in one trip? And I told him after just very brief reflection that sure, we could do it. It would be just a matter of allowing enough time and enough fuel to do so. But then he said, President Eisenhower was very upset with the Pentagon for not giving him the opportunity to mention your just completed under ice work. What had happened was an individual Navy personnel in the Pentagon had given a speech and had released the fact that USS Nautilus had operated extensively under the polar ice pack at a time when, prior to that release, that mission had been classified secret. When President Eisenhower heard about the fact that this had been released, he hit the ceiling, so to speak, and said, in effect, said, "My goodness," or stronger words perhaps, "if there's ever a time when I need to be talking about something positive among U.S. technical capabilities, it's now, with that damn Sputnik flying by overhead and with our own missile failures, missiles going, blowing up on the launching pad."
Let me interrupt you for purposes of clarification. Eisenhower was upset that the Pentagon hadn't informed him earlier about
exactly.
That. Okay.
Exactly.
So he wasn't so much upset about the press release that released classified information as the fact that he hadn't been told in the first place.
Well, that's exactly right. And he felt that he should have been given the option of making the announcement himself, particularly in light of the Sputnik and the our own missile failures. So I came back in conversation with Captain Oran, who'd asked about a trip all the way around the world submerged, and I, with his comments, had the flavor that the President himself was very interested in demonstrating something in the area of where we were definitely ahead, not just ahead, but way ahead of the Soviets. And that was in the field of nuclear submarines. I looked at Captain Rand's world chart, and I said, well, now, it might be around the world in one trip be fine, but there might be something that would have greater, be a greater challenge and would have a greater impact, and that would be, it might be possible for Nautilus to go from one ocean to the other by way of the Arctic and by way of the North Pole. And he agreed that that would have greater impact and told me to let him work on it. That treated as absolutely very, very secret, the very idea of it, and that we keep in touch. So that was the genesis of what turned out to be the successful crossing in 1958.
Can you elaborate a little more on why your book too emphasizes the secrecy in the planning? Why do you think this had to be kept so secret?
It was on orders of the president himself. He, being upset because he wasn't given the option of announcing a 1957 work in the Arctic, directed in very strong terms the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Burke, and the officers who worked under the Admiral, to the effect that if this thing proved to be successful, or whether it was successful or not successful, that he was to make the announcement himself from the White House, and he put that word out in no uncertain terms. And as you can imagine, my direction from my own bosses, my own chain of command, going right up to the top Navy Admiral, Admiral Burke, was that this thing was to be kept absolutely top secret. No word could leak on this, it had to be secret.
Okay, so it really didn't, from what you're telling me, it really didn't have, didn't seem to have anything to do with Soviet activities, but rather more that Eisenhower wanted the opportunity to announce the event if there was in fact going to be a successful event.
Right, and he even said whether successful or not, if it had failed, he still wanted the opportunity to be the one that announced the situation.
And it was the Sputnik environment that very much colored the sense of
the Sputnik and our own difficulty getting launched into the space era.
Okay.
That is correct. We were not really very much concerned about running into Soviet opposition with their own submarines. We were pretty cocky. We knew we were way, way far ahead of them, and we could outdo them in anything that we wanted to outdo them in.
Okay. That's useful. Captain Anderson, if we can talk a little bit more about the planning of the operation.
Okay. The first question, of course, is if one is going to go from ocean to ocean by way of the Arctic ice pack underneath it, is whether or not you go from the Atlantic to the Pacific, or whether vice versa. We knew from our experience in 1957 that there's good deep water all the way from the Atlantic side up to the pole, or at least as close to the pole as we had gotten, and there were some soundings available at the pole itself from other explorations. The question was negotiating the Bering Strait, the region off Alaska, and the approaches from the Pacific to the Arctic Ocean, where you have shallow water and you have ice that has been adrift along the coast and can be quite deep. In other words, you're bound to have a squeeze problem. Well, to us it made sense to let's get the tough part over first. When we have great navigational accuracy, or the best navigational accuracy, and go from Pacific to Atlantic. So that was how the mission was planned.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
One of the other things that we did, Dr. Lyon, Waldo Lyon, who was our chief scientist and who was the real scientist pioneer in submarine under ice work, throughout his entire professional history. We wanted to take a look at the route that Nautilus would follow. We wanted to fly up over it to get some kind of a feel on of the ice thickness and so on. So Waldo Lyon arranged for the two of us to go up to Alaska incognito and plain old civilian clothes and with a fake ID card on both parts. And he arranged for a charter flight by a small aircraft flown by a bush pilot to take us out over the coastal region or a little bit off the coast where Nautilus would be trying to make a penetration and go through. This told us a certain amount, but flying over the ice, there's a limited amount of information you can determine as far as what's really going to happen underneath.
And I believe there was also the point that the airplane itself had some mechanical difficulties, so you didn't get out as much as you had planned.
Oh, you've got a good memory. Yes, here we were in this small, very limited aircraft, and Waldo and I wanted to fly more off the coast, which would be more where Nautilus would be going, so we had coaxed the pilot to fly out, divert from his route, planned route, a certain amount. And this ran us low on fuel. And the pilot said, well, I think we've got some gas cached away over at this little Eskimo village over here. And so he landed on the beach, and a group of Eskimos came down to meet the plane, and he was skilled in conversing with them, and pretty soon they started bringing down 5-gallon cans of aviation gas and loaded it into the aircraft. Well, Walter and I thought that our career might come to a rather short situation with the secrecy that was imposed. And here we were, the pilot revved up his engines and he couldn't move. His wheels had mired down into the sand to the extent that even throwing on full power, he couldn't get the aircraft to move. So you can imagine what was going on in Waldo's mind and ours. Here we were potentially stranded in a remote Eskimo village, two guys with fake ID cards and so on. So this pilot, resourceful as he was, and which is characteristic of bush pilots, they learn how to operate under very strange circumstances. He conversed with the Eskimo group and he lined up two or three on each wing to physically give a push to the airplane, and they were successful in getting just a little bit of motion, and then finally we got some acceleration and took off. As I recall, we just barely cleared a ledge of rocks on the beach by maybe a couple of feet, but we got airborne again. Well, that's a sidelight to the whole story.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you made more than one effort to cross the ocean Your first to cross from Pacific to Atlantic, your first effort was not successful. Can you comment on why it was not successful? And can you also go over a little bit more about why the decision was made to cross from the Pacific to the Atlantic?
On our first effort to make the crossing, we expected to have a squeeze problem off Alaska because of deep ice and shallow water. It proved to be even more severe than we had estimated. We got into a situation rather abruptly where we had almost a collision with unexpectedly deep ice. After moving down to cruise just as close as we safely could to the ocean floor, with, as I recall, maybe 15 or 20 feet clearance between the keel and the bottom of the sea, we cleared a deep ridge of ice by about 5 feet, and it was getting deeper as it looked on sonar up ahead. I had no choice, or felt I had no choice at the time, to take any further risk. We were rushing the season somewhat. This, as I recall, was in June. So, with great disappointment and reluctantly, we turned around, reported into the chain of command and the Pentagon what had happened, and made recommendations that we lay over in Hawaii, make another effort a little bit later when the ice would have retreated to the maximum extent what could occur in late July. This was a bad time for us. I was very fearful that the reaction at the Pentagon would be that, well, this thing is just too risky. Let's just call it off and tell Anderson to proceed as his cover story had indicated, go back south, go back through the canal and come home. Fortunately, the Admiral Burke in the Pentagon and his submarine officers on his staff were sympathetic to giving it another try, and that's what we did. On the second try, which occurred in late July, although we still had the squeeze problem, we were able to find our way into what's known now, or maybe even then, as the Barra Sea Valley, which is, so you might say, the magic submarine route into the Arctic from the Pacific side. Once we got into deep water, we had no problems whatsoever. We had an inertial navigation system. We navigated with great accuracy. And on August 3rd of 58, crossed underneath the pole and emerged from the edge of the pack 2 days later, okay, having completed a transit, as I recall, about 1,830 miles under ice.
Was this Barrow Sea Valley, was that known at the time?
I believe it was. I can recall, I believe, discussions with Dr. Lyon.
We need to change the side of the table. I'm getting the warning just a moment.